You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, February 27, 2019.
A housing report found a surplus of vacant homes across the state of Indiana. We'll hear about a new report that says the home building industry never fully recovered from the Great Recession later in the program.
And smartphones can track your position and usage regardless of what apps you've installed. Today on our weekly Consumer Watchdog program, smartphones and application tracking. Better beware coming up later in the program, but first, your daily headlines.
A bill that would change the rates consumer lenders can charge borrowers narrowly passed in the state Senate last night. As WFHB correspondent Jake Jacobson reports, the new rules still have to be approved by the State House of Representatives.
State lawmakers are changing the rules for lending practices. Yesterday was the last day for bills to be brought up in the State Senate or the State House of Representatives. One of those bills, Senate Bill 613, passed through the State Senate last night. Current Indiana law limits lenders to a 36% annual interest rate on loans under $2,000. Loans over that amount have lower interest rates. Under Indiana code, charging twice that percentage can be prosecuted as criminal loan sharking. Under Senate Bill 613, which is now heading to the State House of Representatives, that 36% annual interest rate would apply to loans of all sizes. Senate Bill 613 would also change Indiana code's definition of criminal loan sharking by including a non-refundable prepaid finance charge on top of the 72% cap. The 69-page bill narrowly passed its third reading on the Senate floor in a 26-23 vote yesterday. 13 Republicans broke ranks and sided with Democrats in opposition to the lending bill. Indiana Republicans hold a supermajority in the State House. In the State Senate, they control 40 of the chamber's 50 seats. Another bill, which would have expanded what Indiana law considers criminal actions by lenders, was defeated on the floor in an equally close vote. Senate Bill 104 was defeated along a 22-27 vote in the Senate. Senate Bill 613 would also create small-dollar loans. Republican Senator Andy Zay, who authored the bill, says these loans are necessary to fill gaps between traditional loans and the payday loan industry, but the small-dollar loans worry Indiana consumer advocacy groups. An analysis of the bill by the Indiana Institute for Working Families found small-dollar loans could include fees and charges with up to 99% interest rates. According to the Indiana Institute for Working Families, one in three Hoosiers has a debt in collections. Senate Bill 613 passed on the Senate floor yesterday. It now awaits action in the House of Representatives. It has been sponsored in the House by Republican Representative Matt Lehman and co-sponsored by Majority Whip Bob Heaton of Indianapolis and Whiteland Republican Representative Woody Burton. For WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
The city of Bloomington is partnering with a local environmental coalition in its efforts to control invasive plants at city parks and trails. The Bloomington Board of Park Commissioners approved a partnership agreement with Monroe County Identify and Reduce Invasive Species yesterday. City landscaper Joanna Sparks told the park board the partnership will go live starting Saturday, March 2nd at Griffey Lake. Sparks said the Saturday event is the first of several invasive plant awareness days.
But we would like to officially begin our partnership this coming Saturday at Griffey. We want to join with them to do partly an invasive plant awareness and education day and a sort of a work day to teach people how to control invasives on their properties and come help us. So, and it's also sort of an outreach to the public to perhaps participate in our Adopt an Acre program at the property nearest them. We're excited to launch our first Saturdays Invasive Plant Awareness Days. They'll be March through November, the first Saturday of each month from 1 to 4, and we're going to hit different properties to try to draw in different neighborhoods.
Sparks also described the city's invasives removal and reforestation efforts along the Bloomington Rail Trail. Sparks said the project began last spring on the section from Country Club Road Trailhead to Gordon Pike. The city hired ecological restoration firm Ecologic to mow down 7 miles worth of bush honeysuckle and treat a large swath of purple winter creeper.
We're really pleased with the results. We seeded native wildflowers and grasses last December. We put down native seed, and we are ordering several thousand tree seedlings to work on getting reforestation going along that trail corridor, where because it is so disturbed, I guess, for lack of a better word, we're going with the planted heavy and hope that, you know, one out of 25 will make it, just because the soil is so terrible and it's rail corridor.
The Park Board renewed the city's contract with Ecologic for the next leg of the project. It goes from Gordon Pike to that road. In other business, Parks Director Paula McDevitt presented a proposal for a new tree abatement process. The proposed 7-step process gives the city the right to remove or prune any hazardous private tree located in the right-of-way.
The city can determine if there is a public hazard or a threat to health, safety, life, or property because of a tree, and if that happens, the following steps will occur. The Urban Forestry Certified Tree Assessors, if we have two on staff, will make the determination of the tree's condition. And if they determine that this tree is in violation of that, they will, step two, send a notice of violation via certified mail to the homeowner. And along with that information will be information for the homeowner if they want to appeal that notice. The homeowner has 15 working days to remove or prune the tree and contact us and let us know of their plans to do so. That's the best case scenario.
McDevitt said if the homeowner does not respond within 15 days, the city will send a second notice by certified mail, along with information on how to appeal. Under the new code, the park commissioners will hear any appeals or, if needed, approve the abatement.
After the tree is removed or pruned, the city controller's office will send the homeowner by certified mail an invoice for the cost of that, either pruning or removal. And the homeowner has 10 days to pay that. If the homeowner fails to pay that statement, then Parks will file a special assessment with the Monroe County Auditors to place a lien on the property.
McDevitt said the proposed tree abatement process is based on a similar process used by the city's Department of Housing and Neighborhood Development. Park Commissioner Kathleen Mills asked McDevitt for more detail about the process.
Do you anticipate this will be on a sort of case-by-case basis, like somebody's out trimming in a park and a whole, you know, private property abuts that and they notice a problem, or are you going to go around with a system of evaluation? Or
we will not be going around with a system of evaluation.
Okay.
If we are out and observe, or sometimes through U reports we get a notice of that, but this is very much private tree that presents a risk to the city, and it's not a private tree on private property that presents a risk to the neighbor, for example. We are strictly looking at this with city lenses.
The proposed abatement process was only under review in yesterday's meeting, the February 26th meeting. Park commissioners will vote on their proposal in their March 26th meeting.
Monroe County Community School Superintendent Judy DeMuth is taking issue with discrepancies in MCCSC teacher compensation data distributed recently by Indiana State Representative Peggy Mayfield. In last night's MCCSC school board meeting, DeMuth provided an excerpt from a handout Mayfield distributed at a recent education presentation. DeMuth said that the handout underrepresented what MCCSC spends on teachers' salaries.
If you notice on the first graph, the information is not correct. What she's showing there is our district tuition support and number of students, neither which are correct. The middle graph is not our school corporation. And the last graph is just a variety of different data points that she picked up from somewhere, trying to really support that we spend more money on all other staff other than teachers. And so, as you can well imagine, as I told her, you know, we're a referendum community. We're very transparent about our money. I take this as a slap in the face. We just passed a major referendum for our community. We put all the information out there. We have credibility in the community. They know that we're going to be spend money in our children's and our teachers' best interest. We've worked diligently to give our teachers raises. We give good benefits. We've taken that very seriously. And I didn't appreciate her coming to town and putting something out to people that really was misleading.
Adam Terwilliger, Interim Assistant Director of Business Operations, also addressed the data in Mayfield's handout.
I don't know if you can read that back there, but it says number of all other staff, and it says percent of change 2011 to 2014, and the bar next to it says teacher benefit. That's a person and a dollar amount on the same x-axis. So you could be talking about the difference between $100 to $116, I'm just going to blow the example up, or $100 to 177 people, and saying that you're comparing 1% of change to another one when it's a mismanaged reference.
Terwilliger said he tried to recreate Representative Mayfield's data using the source she cited, LSA school funding data, but could not find the source data. Using payroll data MCCSC submits biannually to the state, Terwilliger created what he deemed a more accurate bar graph.
Teacher wage bar chart, as you see from 2016 to 2018, you can tell by that slope we're doing pretty well. Compared to all other wage, teacher wage, this is a percent of change graph that makes sense to me. It compares dollars to dollars. 8.8% up over the course of 2016 to 18 versus 2.5% all other wage. So you can tell that we're really putting a lot of our capital into human capital, the teachers of our corporation. Down below is a percent of allocation of expense of the general fund. You can tell that we are quite robust in terms of wage and benefits. Our general fund, as it has existed since 2014, is basically in the high 90s, mid-90s for wage and benefits versus all other expenses. So it kind of debunks the whole theory of we spend money on widgets. We are spending money on people, period.
Terwilliger said he also looked to the Indiana Employment Education Relations Board for the most recent data on teacher salaries. Terwilliger said from 2015 to 2018, MCCSC paid well over $5,000 above the state average per teacher. Superintendent DeMuth said she has met with Representative Mayfield about the discrepancies. DeMuth also spoke to what she referred to as a bait and switch by the Indiana General Assembly in its rhetoric on education funding.
You heard the governor talk about kind of shifting some pension money to make it appear that teachers were going to get more money. That's kind of out there on the table. We keep hearing, you know, Brian Bosma say we're going to give schools 2 and 3%. Unfortunately, we got our printout recently, and for next year, it's anticipated that we would receive 1.5% new money, and the following year, 1.7%. And an unfortunate part of that also is that now they've decided, again, it's kind of a bait and switch, to add Title I monies in there, which Title I is a federal categorical grant. We have always gotten that money. But when you show an increase in Title I monies to us, then it jacks up our supposed increase to 2.4%. So when you hear them talking about 2.5%, 3%, it's not happening. Our printout right now is 1.5, 1.7, and we're lobbying hard to get more money, new money, for our teachers in the state of Indiana.
A recent report from the Legislative Services Agency predicts a $60 million funding shortfall for the 2019-2020 school year. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. Construction of the city's Switchyard Park is currently underway, and that means that the Beeline Trail, which runs across the park, may be affected. As Rasha Kamhawi reports, a section of the trail is closed today and tomorrow.
A section of the Beeline Trail is closed today and tomorrow while construction takes place to install two prefabricated bridges. David Williams is Director of Operations and Development at the City of Bloomington Parks and Recreation Department. Williams says cranes will be swinging two large bridges into place along the Beeline Trail for the city's Switchyard Park.
South of the bridge crossing over Grimes Lane to the side path connection south of the park property, the Switchyard area that leads to Rogers Street, that section of the Beeline Trail will be closed until all the loading, unloading, and setting of these two bridge components have been completed.
The City of Bloomington is encouraging commuters that regularly use the Beeline Trail along the upcoming Switchyard Park area to instead use the sidewalks along South Rogers Street. According to a press release from the City of Bloomington, the alternate route is marked with Beeline Trail detour signs. The erection of the two bridges is part of the construction of the city's Switchyard Park. The park will be made up of 65 acres and is planned to include a dog park, playground, splash pad, and skate park. Construction of the park began in May of last year. Williams says the park is expected to open in November of this year.
That would mean buildings that are occupiable, a park that is usable by the public. It may not include every tree being planted, every native plant being planted, some of the landscape items that typically are last items on any large project such as this. But we have every intention of having a park opened for public use by the end of the year, and then we'll follow up with any lingering landscaping work and what they call punch list items that need to be corrected by the contractor. They have until the end of May 2020 to complete.
According to Williams, the Beeline Trail will reopen to users no later than 7 p.m. tomorrow. Users of the trail should expect further closures and detours down the line as construction takes place.
There will be a new Beeline bypass trail that will be constructed because a main portion of the Beeline Trail that runs through the center of the new Switchyard Park will be removed and reconstructed. So we will have a detour for trail users later in the year that will allow Beeline Trail users to go immediately east to the Clear Creek area. There will be a pathway constructed alongside Clear Creek, and that will go the entire length of the Switchyard Park and then rejoin the main Beeline Trail. So in the period between now and when that bypass is constructed, we may have continued temporary closures and appreciate the public's patience.
The Beeline Trail extends for a little over 3 miles from Adams Street to Country Club Drive. It connects to the Bloomington Rail Trail at Country Club Drive, offering about 5 miles of trail. For WFHB, I'm Rasha Kamhawi.
Support for WFHB comes from Cardinal Spirits Distillery, located on the Beeline. Cardinal Spirits has opened a new kitchen featuring local, seasonal food made from scratch to complement their craft cocktails. Dinner available Tuesday through Saturday at Cardinal Spirits, 922 South Morton Street.
A new report out this year cited that Indiana builders aren't continuing construction on new houses across the state. As WFHB correspondent Jake Jacobson reports, that's due to a supposed surplus of housing.
Indiana has too many vacant homes and an unprofitable home building industry. That's according to a new study released from the Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research. Dr. Dagny Falk is the director of research at the Ball State Center. She says the study found housing vacancies throughout the state, despite reports of a housing shortage in Indiana.
One of the drivers behind this research was several media reports have reported that there are housing shortages in certain submarkets of the sector. And in some places around the state, there hasn't been any new housing developments begun since the Great Recession. So even though we've been in a long period of recovery, The housing market seems to have lagged. So we were looking at some of the basic economic forces that would explain why that would occur.
The study takes a look at the perceived housing shortage in Indiana by examining the forces that affect housing availability. Dr. Falk says the state's housing market hasn't fully recovered since the Great Recession.
In many other areas of the state, particularly areas that have experienced declines in manufacturing employment and population declines, we see a situation where the housing vacancy rate is quite high, and that there's very little building of new housing or new housing starts is the variable that's measured. And part of that is because housing is such a durable good, right? It lasts for a long time. I mean, you can see houses that are still occupied that are 100 years old. And as the population declines, you know, housing doesn't decline immediately with population. So a lot of areas are left with an overabundance of housing. And over time, some of the older housing tends to deteriorate.
The Ball State study looks county to county at speculative home building, where a developer will build a neighborhood assuming that those homes will sell. Dr. Falk says speculative home building is profitable in less than 15% of counties in Indiana.
One of the things that we do when we're comparing the profitability of building new houses is that we actually look county by county and find that it's only in 14 counties that it's profitable to build houses, that the data shows that it's profitable, whereas in 62 counties it shows that it's not, that the cost of constructing new housing is higher than the price, the market price that people are willing to pay.
Dr. Falk says that the Ball State study found a disconnect between public perceptions of the state's housing market versus housing availability.
It's just simple economic fundamentals that the cost of building the home is higher than the price that a home buyer is willing to pay for that home. And if the cost of building that house is higher than the price that a developer would expect to get, then the developer won't be willing to build that house.
The study recommends policy changes to help policymakers address Indiana housing issues, including one that Dr. Falk says is not an uncommon solution.
Some of the points that we make toward the end of the report are some policy considerations for local officials, and one of which has come up over and over in several different studies that we've done is focusing on quality of life characteristics, because that seems to have, that does have a direct relationship to the price that people are willing to pay for housing. So things like the quality of local schools, amenities such as parks and recreational opportunities, those add value. Those have been shown in empirical research to add value to housing. So that sort of focus, policy focus, I think is needed in a lot of areas.
The Ball State study, titled Economic Considerations for Indiana's Housing Markets, found that rising costs of building materials and availability of current housing across the state does not make new home construction economically advantageous. The city of Bloomington has the most expensive housing and rental market in the state, while Monroe County, Brown County, and Lawrence counties have a moderately saturated housing market, according to the study. Dr. Falk said part of that surplus housing is due to area populations growing at a slower pace than the national average. For WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Okay, everybody's got a smartphone these days. Even I've got one, so I'm sure you do. But did you realize just how much that thing in your pocket is telling people about you? Your phone knows exactly where you are right this moment. You probably know that. It has to know if you use it for getting directions. But unless you tell it to stop, your phone automatically tells a lot of people, a lot of other computers, a lot of companies, just where you are, where you're going, and what you're doing. It's not just your location being tracked, it's your behavior. You gave your phone permission to do that because phones and the apps on them generally come with permission turned on. If you want your phone to stop tracking you, you've got to tell it to stop, and you'll have to tell it several times in several ways. I can't give detailed instructions for every kind of phone, but I can tell you what to check, and you can find the how-to with a quick search. Regardless of whether you've got an iPhone or an Android phone or whatever, there will be a way to get into its settings. In settings, you will find location and a way to completely turn off location tracking or to turn it off for different applications. You may be able to set different apps to only track your location when an app is actually being used. But if you don't, and it's turned on at all, those apps will track you 24 hours a day. Most phones also have a way to erase your location history. Then there's ad tracking. Info from your phone allows advertisers to build up a profile, which tells them what kind of ads to send you. There are settings to limit this or turn it off. On an iPhone, they're under privacy, but an Android phone has them under your Google account. If you have an Android phone or apps connected to Google on an iPhone, if you have a Google account at all, you have to change your settings there, too. Log in, go to Personal and Privacy, and manage your activity controls. To stop Google, not your phone, but Google itself, from tracking your location, you need to pause your location history and your web and app activity. Beyond that, you have to turn off location and activity tracking in your browser and in any and every account you've established online. Start using a search engine like DuckDuckGo.com that doesn't track your searches. Most people have quite a few apps on their phone, and each app will have its own settings for permissions. Check them all. If you don't learn how to control your phone, it may be too smart for your own good. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jake Jacobson, Sarah Vaughn, and Rasha Kamhawi in partnership with CATS Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Jake Jacobson.
Our engineer today, Kevin Oliver. Executive producer, Wes Martin. Our theme music provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Danny Graff, and Scott Schmadeke. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.
And I'm Barbara Fuqua. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. Hereabouts is produced in partnership with the Asian Cultural Center on the campus of Indiana University, Bloomington. That's Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio, coming up next on WFHB.